Before you start listening to this podcast, we've got a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, which will give you full access to everything on our website, and we'll also throw in a free £20 Amazon voucher. Just go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by Fraser Nelson and James Forsyth. So we've just had the Prime Minister's press conference and he had some good news. The appeal launched yesterday to get members of the public to volunteer to help the NHS has already met its target. The government were aiming for 250,000 and they have already had 405,000 people sign up. However, when it comes to a test, which we expect to take the UK some way to getting back to normal life, there may still be a bit of a wait. James, what did the Prime Minister and his team have to say today?
So, in evidence to the Science and Technology Committee of the House of Commons today, the Public Health England suggested that this test, you know, might be available as soon as next week, and that people could possibly kind of buy it on Amazon or in Boots. And I think there was a lot of excitement this afternoon that you might be able to kind of test yourself sooner rather than later. I think what came very apparent in this press conference from what Chris Whitty was saying is that ain't going to be happening anytime soon, because first of all, they want to evaluate the test before it's used. His colleague Patrick Vallance, you know, made the point that a bad test was worse than no test at all. And then secondly, once they've got the test, you know, they will want to be kind of doing a kind of clinical checks on that test. And obviously that test is going to go first to NHS workers and other key workers. So it's going to be quite some time before Joe Public can get their hands on a test. I think the antibody test, in a way, is more of a game changer than the test for simply finding out who has it. But I think on that test for who has it, there were again quite a lot of hostile questions about why this country isn't testing at the level of a Singapore or a South Korea, where testing has enabled them to avoid the kind of restrictions that are currently in place in the UK.
Fraser, as James mentions in the press conference, lots of difficult questions to the Prime Minister on the level of testing. Boris Johnson pointed out that if you compare the UK to European countries, they're not doing too badly in terms of the level of testing so far. How do you think people are judging the government's response? Because there's been a YouGov poll this week which suggests that actually Boris Johnson's popularity is the highest it's been since he became Prime Minister.
Yes, that's true. And also Donald Trump's popularity is surging in America right now. When you get clear leadership in a crisis, people tend to respond well to it. Of course, journalists will always point out flaws in the day-to-day operation. But generally, the Prime Minister seemed to be quite calm, assured, and the lockdown, weirdly, is popular. Public opinion was almost pressurising him to say that we should all stay in our houses. So, so far, it seemed to be performed quite well. Now, of course, there are lots of questions about the test and the protective clothing, but most importantly, you've got doctors who are self-isolating at home because their flatmate had a cough or something. They've got to stay home for 14 days and they're itching to get back to the front line at a time where the NHS desperately needs doctors, and they can't do it because there aren't any tests. Now, this is obviously a ridiculous situation. There are tens of thousands of tests in South Korea and Singapore and China, but none of them seem to be working the way over here. And even if you could get hold of a few thousands more, you could be directing them at the NHS workers, for example, who ought to be first in the queue. Now, I imagine Boris Johnson was quite tempted to say, well, I inherited a pretty bad pandemic plan from my predecessor, because he didn't come up with this plan, obviously. The plan involved having lots of protective clothing for doctors. But as Dr. Max Pemberton says in our cover story out tomorrow, the doctors found that this protective clothing was past its best before date. It was out of date by the time it was needed. And nobody had actually thought to check if it was still in date. So we are seeing lots of failures. But the biggest difference between the European and the American reaction and the Asian reactions is the Asian pandemic planning was well prepared with these tests. Europeans, Britain amongst them, certainly weren't. So yes, it has exposed a deep problem in UK pandemic planning.
James, with Boris Johnson under fire in some quarters, one of the ideas which appeared to have died when Boris Johnson won a decisive majority is the idea of a government of national unity. Now, this isn't just critics of Boris Johnson talking about it. We've also had some Tory MPs go public. One of the ideas being that this could be a way, given the next few weeks are going to be very difficult, that the Tories could shoulder the blame of another party if you bring Labour more into decision making. Is this just pie in the sky?
I think your blog has it right this morning, Katie, which is that it essentially is pie in the sky unless we're in a situation where Parliament can't meet for months and months and months, you know, kind of 6 months or something like that. In which case, I think because the government would not be accountable to Parliament in the normal way, you would need a kind of different kind of structure of government. But I don't think we are currently looking at that. So I think it is currently pie in the sky. I also think there's, you know, that in some ways we've all become slightly obsessed with this idea of governments of national unity over the past 2 years, and we can't quite kick the habit. Just to come back to your question to Fraser, I think the evidence today from Neil Ferguson at Imperial College, who's the kind of the modeller on whom the government is relying, he said today that he thought that the current trend suggested that this disease would stay within the NHS's capacity to deal with it, that while some hospitals' ICU units might be overwhelmed, the overall national capacity would not be. Now, there is obviously, you know, a lot of caveats to that. We can't know for sure. I think we are finding out that epidemiological models have limitations in just the way that economic models do. But if Neil Ferguson, on whose advice the government is so reliant, is right on this point, then I think that the impact of his crisis will in some ways be limited politically, because what Neil Ferguson's advice today is saying is we are not going to see the kind of scenes in the UK that we have seen in Lombardy, for instance. Now, all of these things should be heavily caveated. But I think if that is the case, if it does stay within the capacity of the NHS to deal with the crisis, then I think that this event will be less of a defining political event in terms of the government's competence or perceptions thereof, as people might have thought previously.
I think, James, there are two ways of interpreting that statement. One is to say that there is going to be a surge in deaths and that the NHS will be able to cope with it. The other way of interpreting it is that there's not going to be as much of a surge in deaths as they had expected. Now, right now, the Imperial College modelling is controversial. I know quite a few people in government who think that it's at the more pessimistic end. And this morning we had the other end of the spectrum from Oxford University, where they're saying that perhaps most people in the country have already had COVID, that for most people it wasn't bothersome, they didn't particularly regard themselves as being ill, it might have been asymptomatic for a lot of them. This casts a fundamental different approach in how we understand this disease and the likely burden on the NHS. Very different to Imperial, who are talking about 18 months. Oxford is talking about a 3-month duration over this. So now, for the moment, all Imperial is offering is a model, a forecasting model. All Oxford University is offering is a model, a forecasting model. Now, this is why I think what they were saying today about blood tests is so important, because when the blood tests come out, we will then be able to test how much of the country has actually got this, how far up the curve we have, whether it is, for example, do 10% of London have they had it? Is it 25%? Is it 40%? When these blood tests were developed, it was a real breakthrough in understanding swine flu in 2009. And I think this technology will take us out of the realms of a theoretical, because right now we've got no idea if we're in the Oxford model, and in which case we'll be pushing coronavirus into reverse after Easter, or the Imperial model, in which case we'll be fighting it for most of this year. Now, so much depends on this. The lockdown depends on this. The state of the NHS depends on this. The trajectory of the country depends on which of these models is more accurate. The true form is certainly somewhere between the two. But when we get the blood tests, we'll know for sure. And only then will we get more of an idea.
Now, there's an absolutely fascinating piece by Dr. John Lee in the Spectator, which is out tomorrow online and in shops on Friday, distributors willing. And he is making the point in this that fast science is often bad science, and everyone is moving so quickly to try and understand this new disease that we should be sceptical about lots of the studies and claims. And I think one of the things which can be confusing in this crisis is the government talks about following the science, right? It's very much the definite article, the science. But the problem is, as lots of people in government will say, there isn't one scientific view on this situation. And what we are finding out that epidemiology, it isn't like kind of physics. It is much more involves projections and value judgments. And as always with these models, what the models come out with depends on what you put into it. And I think one of the things we are discovering is that in a situation like this, saying that you're following the science is a little bit like saying you're following the economics. There isn't just one view of what the situation is. And as Fraser said, until we get this antibody test, we won't know which of these models is right. Now, I think you can see an argument that from an abundance of caution, the government is right to take the measures it is taking, because if it is the imperial model, you definitely need to take those measures, and much better safe than sorry. But I think there is so much we still don't know about this virus. That is why this test to find out how many people have had it cannot come soon enough, because that is what will enable a much more informed policy making than we currently have.
And finally, MPs are heading home for the recess, expected to be back at some point in April, though this could be pushed back depending on the coronavirus. This means it was Jeremy Corbyn's last day in the Commons today as Labour leader and his final PMQs. James, were you impressed with his final efforts?
Well, he got kind of two bites at the cherry. Because Parliament is rising a week early, they had kind of two sessions of PMQs, one straight after the other. Jeremy Corbyn definitely got better at PMQs as time as Labour leader went on, but that wasn't that hard. And I think he was again reiterating today that he's not retiring, that he's still going to make his voice heard. And I think if I was Keir Starmer, I would slightly thinking, oh crikey, the last thing that he needs is, as he faces the difficulty of establishing himself as Labour leader at a time when everyone's attention is elsewhere, is Jeremy Corbyn kind of continuing to pop up and make points. So I think that is... And that's going to be a challenge for the new Labour leader if Jeremy Corbyn is going to keep going. I don't think that anyone will look back on Corbyn's performances at PMQs and remember them as vintage performances. William Hague never got to be Prime Minister, but people did think that he was good at PMQs. I don't think anyone would put Jeremy Corbyn in that league, or even he wasn't even as good as Ed Miliband at it.
Fraser, finally, how will you remember Jeremy Corbyn's time as Labour leader?
I am going to be a bit kinder than most other people, I think, will be to Jeremy Corbyn. I think that, here is a man who was laughed off as a national joke, came within a stone's throw of getting into Downing Street, deprived the Tories of their majority. He increased the Labour share of the vote in the 2015 election more than any other party of any other leader in our post-war history. I disagree with every single thing that he stands for. But there's no doubt that he is a man of integrity, a man of principle, a man who is not in politics to enrich himself. He is in politics for the right reasons. It just is a shame that this his high principle was in the service of such a destructive agenda. He's the sort of person that you, in a way, you want to see in politics, somebody who was only ever driven to come into the House of Commons because he thought politics could change the world for the better. And he never stopped being devoted to what he believed was right, even at a time where everybody else was laughing at him. For a while he came into vogue, it's not so much in vogue now, but he is a man of principle, and that's how I'm going to remember him.
Thank you, Fraser. Thank you, James.